Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online contributing editor, Natasha Bogutsky.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online editor-in-chief, Rich Dries. How's it going, Rich?
It's going pretty good. Can't complain. Started off this weekend by watching one of my all-time favorite films on the big screen, so it's a good way to start.
I'm guessing that would be Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Indeed it would be.
Isn't it celebrating an anniversary this year?
Nope. Released in 1980, so...
That's really weird.
I'm sorry, 1981, excuse me. So, no anniversary. It was just part of the classics series at a local theater in town.
Which is funny, because down, I believe, Philadelphia, they were doing a live concert.
Yeah, that was last weekend.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend. We had some friends who went and had a wonderful time.
That's why I was asking, is there an anniversary or something I should know about?
No, it's just the timing. Everybody loves Raiders of the Lost Ark. And why wouldn't you? Wait, what?
I'm a Last Crusade girl.
I know. But
it's the snakes, man. I can't do the snakes.
I understand. But Raiders is one of those films, though, that I just enjoy so much that whenever I get a chance to see it on a big screen, I go. You know, and I've driven 2.5 hours to see it on a big screen. I've driven down to the Philly area a couple of times, Lancaster.
Did you do
New
Mahoning?
York City? The Mahoning Drive-In outside of Allentown. A wonderful drive-in if you're in the eastern Pennsylvania area. You might want to check that place out. It's nothing but old films, revival films, genre stuff.
In 35mm.
Yes. So I'm actually looking forward. I think they've got a Godzilla Palooza weekend coming up soon.
Oh,
that's
going
to be fun. And a few other things.
They're about a couple, 2-3 weeks late. And that's the only time you'll ever hear me say that phrase on this podcast.
True, but I think that might have been just a scheduling thing of when they could get the prints. I think maybe Toho wanted to give the American version a little bit of breathing room before they started getting prints back out into circulation for revivals. Anyways, but yeah, I mean, I know Raiders of the Lost Ark has some flaws in it. I know there's an incredible logic problem in terms of how tall Indiana Jones is compared to what you hear them talk about in the film. I've told you this one, right?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
You know the film well enough, and let's face it, this film is 30-some years old, so sorry if this is a spoiler to you. When Indy and Sala go to get the headpiece to the staff of Ra translated.
Oh, that.
Yes.
Yeah.
The ancient guy tells them, it says here to make the rod for the staff 6 kadam high. And Indy turns to Sala and goes, oh, that's about 72 inches. So, you know, figure, okay, 72 inches divided by 6 kadam means, you know, 1 kadam equals about a foot. Simple math, right? So a kadam equals a foot. Keep that in mind. And then the old guy flips the headpiece over and says, but take back 1 kadam to honor the Hebrew God for whose ark this is. And so that means, okay, we go from a 5-foot pole down to a 4-foot pole that we put the headpiece on, right? Okay. Now, fast forward to a couple of scenes later when Indy is in the map room with his 4-foot-tall pole that towers over his head. How tall is Indiana Jones here? 3.5 feet tall.
Are you sure you did your math right?
Yes. Or 6 feet minus 1 foot is 5 feet. But still, it means Indy is shorter than a 5-foot staff. So he's what, 3.5, 4 feet tall? It doesn't make sense. It's a really giant blooper that I don't think I noticed for the first 7 or 8 years I've been watching the movie.
Yeah, it would be about a 5-foot tall staff.
Yeah. So it's always so funny that, you know, despite that, you know, something like that, despite when Marion is kidnapped and Indy thinks she dies in the truck explosion, that when the truck flips over, you can see the hydraulic jack that they installed under the truck to flip it flapping in the shot. Despite, you know, little flaws like that, you know, I still love that movie to pieces.
That car chase is awesome.
The cart? Oh my gosh. I need to show you something then.
I know what you're going to show me.
The
fan film.
The fan version of that. If you have not had a chance to see, and this was kind of a big thing several years back, the shot-for-shot remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark, including almost everything, the stunts that these kids did. It was all done by three kids in Louisiana who were like teenagers. And, you know, they're setting their mom's basement on fire to recreate the fire in the bar in Nepal. And it's an amazing thing to see the entire thing. And if you get a chance, if they bring it out somewhere to show it, you know, definitely take that opportunity to see it because it's just amazing. And everybody knows Raiders. So you know what's coming next in the movie, and you're watching these kids recreate these things, and you're suddenly thinking, well, how are they going to pull off this? And how are they going to pull off the next thing? And suddenly, you're not just watching a bunch of kids who remade Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, as a goof on their, you know, summer vacations for 5 years. You're kind of cheering and rooting these kids on to keep doing it and keep doing these stunts and, you know, and recreating these things. And you're just like, how the hell do they do this? It's crazy, but it's a lot of fun. And also Raiders is just one of those films that it's a film that I just enjoy rewatching because of memories of, you know, seeing it for the first and second time, you know, with my dad when it was out in theaters. Dad didn't take us to the movies much. That was, mom would either take us or my older brothers would. So, you know, for dad to come along to a movie was kind of a treat, and he really enjoyed it. And he, you know, it reminded him of those Saturday matinee cliffhangers serials from his youth. And, you know, he kind of told me about that. I sort of knew a little bit about that already because of Star Wars. So that helped fuel a little bit of my film fandom as a kid. And also, Raiders of the Lost Ark came out in, like, June of 1981. And it was still showing in theaters in November. Because movies, if they were hits, stayed in theaters for a long time. There was no rush to get it out onto home video because that didn't exist quite yet. Some movies would have, like, these incredibly long theatrical runs, which you would never see anymore these days. So you always had the chance to go see a movie multiple times while it was still in the theater. As opposed to, it's been 7 weeks since Avengers Endgame came out, and it's almost out of theaters now. You know, the amount of screenings are really, you know, marked down. I'm not even sure it's in the top 10 anymore at this point. If it is, it's just barely. But it's the biggest hit movie of the year. And boom, it's gone. It's almost gone inside of 2 months. You know, it's crazy how kind of things have changed like that. But going to Raiders, you know, and over again, and this is one of those movies that I can always just pop on. You know, if I'm having a bad day at work, I'll come home and pop that on. Or if I'm channel surfing and I see that it's on, boom, it just stays on. It can be in the background or whatever. It's one of those comfort movies, that a film that you're so comfortable with that you don't mind watching it over and over again, especially because it maybe brings back a certain feeling or a certain thought. And I was wondering, do you have any kind of films like that?
Absolutely. Okay. A lot of them are my favorite films, such as Black Swan, Double Indemnity, Psycho.
All feel-good movies.
Moulin Rouge. Even to a certain extent, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet is a comfort film for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there are any feel-good films in my comfort movies.
Well,
I'm not a feel-good fan.
I know.
I mean, I that's not true. I am. I just wouldn't consider them to be comfort films for me.
You wouldn't consider them. You wouldn't consider feel-good films comfort films for you.
No, I don't think I can list one that is a feel-good film for me.
Alrighty. Well, let's break down one of these for us. Black Swan. I know this is like an all-time favorite film.
Yes.
And one that has immense rewatchability for you.
Oh, yes.
What is it about that film that speaks to you, though, that makes you want to, I had a bad day at work. I want to watch this.
The idea of perfection.
Okay.
And attaining that at all costs. And that is something that on a day-to-day basis, I mean, you've got you've got your boss ripping into you over doing a shitty job at work, or at home you're doing a shitty job with doing something else and it's not good enough. It's not good enough. And therefore, sitting down and watching that makes me feel like, yeah, something that you do can be good enough. But the question is, are you willing to pay the price for it?
Okay, interesting. I like that. No, I see your point. But that's a movie that is addressing a concern that you are having when you come home from work. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you like to watch that makes you forget everything? That's, you know, just movie as escapism. That's your warm, fuzzy blanket. I was like, screw the world. I'm going to wrap myself up in this movie for 5 minutes or the full 2-hour runtime just to forget all of my troubles for a few moments.
Probably a toss-up between Double Indemnity, Moulin Rouge, and Kill Bill Volume 1.
Okay. Well, I can definitely see like Moulin Rouge. It's a tragic romance. I can see that as, you know, very, very escapist. You're looking at me like, oh my God, he's saying something nice about a Baz Luhrmann film.
Yes! It has begun.
No. You're not changing me on my opinions of it.
Very soon we will be retro reviewing Moulin Rouge to celebrate its to celebrate its
anniversary?
No.
Oh.
No, it's Broadway open.
Oh, when it becomes a Broadway show, if it does.
Actually, no, it opens in about a month and a half.
Oh, boy. Oh, gosh. I got that coming for me.
Yes, you do.
Hooray. Voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir? Anywho.
Best collaborations in history of music. And I would say Double Indemnity and Kill Bill Volume 1. They are comfort blankets for me.
Okay.
Double Indemnity, I probably watch once a month.
Wow.
Pretty much every time I take a bath, that movie is on my
computer. As opposed to just, yeah, when you take a relaxing bath as opposed to your usual shower.
Yeah.
Just so people don't think you're like a stinky person for 29 days out of the year.
Yes. When I take a relaxing bath, mm-hmm. I will throw on a candle, grab a glass of wine, and stick on Double Indemnity while I'm sitting in the tub.
Okay. Fair enough. I know for a while, several years back, if I had a bad day at work, I would come home. I would put the DVD to High Society in and just watch Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra singing Did You Ever?
Never seen that film, actually.
5 minutes, and I was happy as a lark. I was like, ah, okay, now things are better. That would help me get my equilibrium back.
That's your Singing in the Rain moment.
Kinda. There's, you know, some stuff in Singing in the Rain that's wonderful, too, but that was like this is the song I need to just listen to right now to make me happy. And it's a fun performance, and it's a really well done and just well staged and everything in that movie.
Song in film that made me feel like that is definitely El Tango de Roxanne. I think that's the main reason why I watch Moulin Rouge as a comfort film, is El Tango de Roxanne just always makes me feel better.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. What is the movie that you've probably watched the most times then? Is it outside of a comfort film like Double Indemnity, where you know once a month or so you're probably going to watch it? Is there something else that you've watched a number of times, or a couple of films? You know, feel free to rattle off 3 or 4, 5, 6 titles, because I'm putting you on the spot like this.
Clerks. Give me a second.
You're looking at my shelf right now for titles that jump out at you, I know.
Yeah. Red Shoes, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with your collection and my collection is we overlap in some areas, but it's usually not on the comfort film side. Mm-hmm. Or things that I just rewatch over and over. Some Like It Hot is definitely one that I like to rewatch a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about Feel Good, though. That's definitely one of them.
Oh, yeah. That's a fun film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my favorite Billy Wilder, but I recognize where a lot of people love it.
Yeah, obviously. Vertigo, mainly Psycho, though. A lot of times when I need something that's just rewatchability as a comfort film, I don't go to films. I will go to Outlander, or I will go to Orphan Black or Doctor Who. Just something that I know very well. Mm-hmm. Goldeneye and Casino Royale are big ones that I rewatch.
Interesting.
And I have this thing about King Arthur, so I will rewatch First Knight, Excalibur. I will go and stick in Merlin or the very short-lived Starz TV show Camelot. So yeah, there's a number of things out there.
Okay.
Anastasia, when it comes to animated films, Hunchback Notre Dame, Atlantis, Anastasia, Mulan are usually the ones that I will rewatch over and over and over. A lot of times it's when I want to stick in something so I can sing along.
Yeah, singing along to a movie is also very comforting, I found, especially if you know the movie or and you know some of the dance moves and stuff. So yeah, so sometimes I would be singing along too. Did you ever?
Mm-hmm.
Switching back and forth between the two voices there.
Oh, when I was a kid, Moulin Rouge was just one of those that kind of stuck with me so much that I would act out the whole movie in my bedroom just by myself.
With the movie on or from memory?
With the movie on.
Okay.
I did it a couple times from memory, but
I thought so.
It's not the same.
I know.
It's a little hard to do like music cues in the background when you're only playing one character. and that's the thing. I have the entire film memorized, but when you're acting it out, you choose a character and you stay as that character the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
I chose Satine. So when you have Harold Zidler up there going, again. I mean, you kind of can't do that.
I understand.
And Pan's Labyrinth, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon are also ones.
Oh, wow. Okay.
If you want to go into foreign, those are the two that I love to, mm-hmm. to rewatch over and over and over. What about you?
For comfort movies or things I've seen over and over again? Because, you know, obviously Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Let's try not comfort movies, but things that you watch over and over, and let's see where they overlap in the Venn diagram.
Okay. Well, first of all, I guess I can start with
Buckaroo Banzai.
Well, yeah. And that's because the first weekend we owned a VCR and gotten a membership at a local mom and pop video store. The two movies I rented, one was Buckaroo Banzai because it had just come out on VHS. And can you guess what the second one was?
If you tell me, The Thin Man.
No, it wasn't The Thin Man. I didn't get into The Thin Man until college. This is like my sophomore year of high school.
Richard Donner's Superman.
No, it was Jonathan Demme's concert film, Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense.
Oh, nice.
And basically from Friday night to Sunday, late Sunday afternoon, when we had to return these things before the store closed, I watched those two movies back to back over and over again. I literally think I watched both of those films like four times that weekend, probably driving my parents and my brother insane at the time. But it was just like the novelty of like, oh my God, I can watch this in my home. Because up until that point, the only movie I had ever seen in, you know, more than once outside of like when it was on television and chopped up with commercials and pan and scanned and all that crap was Raiders of the Lost Ark. That was the first movie I saw twice in its initial release. And, you know, once you get into high school and college, you get your own disposable income and your own mode of transportation. Those things change and you can go see a movie more than once. Let's see. I know, for example, I've seen all three Lord of the Rings films at least four times during their initial theatrical run.
Oh, sorry.
I was going to say on the first day of release, I would see them twice with my friend Rich Z. And we would see it. Opening, first showing in the morning on that Friday, we'd go grab lunch and then come back and see another showing. And then Christmas week, I would see it again with any of my nephews and nieces who were visiting my parents for the holidays at that time. And then invariably, I'd see it at least one more time on my own. I'm sure four is probably a low number for theatrical screenings on those films. I know I've seen like the first Avengers film about five or six times. You know, during its initial theatrical release.
The one that holds the record for me was, don't make fun of me for this.
Sidebar, when you tell me not to make fun of you, you know that's going to happen.
Les Mis with 7.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. The Hobbit, Unexpected Journey with 5. And there's another film that I know, I think it might be Infinity War where I got to 5. But yeah, Les Mis still holds the record.
Do you know what movie that came out last year that I saw 5 times in a theater?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Come on. Be nice.
Bathtubs Over Broadway.
Yep. I've never seen a document. I've only seen one other documentary more than once theatrically. And that was Kirby Dick's This Film Is Not Rated, which is amazing. And, you know, like I said, though, this documentary just kind of blew me away. So, yeah, I saw it 5 times in theaters.
You want to talk about films that I've rewatched over and over and over again that are comfort movies?
Mm-hmm.
And you've actually sat through this one with me.
Mm-hmm.
Anna Karenina.
That's true. I could see where you would just enjoy that movie and just kind of let yourself get lost in it.
Mm-hmm. Even though it doesn't end well.
Even though it doesn't end well, yeah. Even though I got nervous in a subway platform with you right after we saw that.
Yeah, because we were going to Tribeca, what, the next week?
Yeah. I was like, what is it about, you know, some of your films? Like you said, you know, how some of them, you know, just help you escape. I don't know what I want to ask here.
You're asking, what is it about them that makes them that?
Yeah. What, you know, like I said, you know, Raiders, you know, reminds me of a time that, you know, my dad came out. My dad worked a lot. He was a manager for a retail store and he was very busy. You know, he worked a lot, you know, had a couple evenings. And when he got home, he had 5 kids he all had to kind of divvy up his attention to. So, you know, and I don't say this in any bad way. You know, I just, you know, didn't have much of a connection with my dad, it felt like, as a kid. So knowing that Raiders was something that we went to, you know, the one of the two times I went to see it, I went with him and he thoroughly enjoyed it. And I remember sitting next to him and just hearing him, you know, reacting positively to all the parts of the movie where, you know, people normally laugh or cheer or what have you. And then him talking about how he would see the movies that inspired this film as a kid, you know, that is part of, I think, maybe why I like Raiders of the Lost Ark. And this is me just thinking about this, you know, a week on after Father's Day, perhaps, but others are, you know, just the pure escapism. Sometimes there's a portion of a movie that just is joyful. It's just, you can't help but smile when you watch it. No matter what kind of crap mood you're in, you're just like, oh yeah, because the filmmakers did such an extraordinary job of capturing that and conveying it through this medium to you that you're attracted and drawn to those things when you need that emotional shift in your life.
I think it just depends on the film for me. Black Swan was the only R-rated movie my mom would never take me to go see. And I could never understand why. I mean, there are movies that we shared when I was younger. I was never shy about watching anything with my parents that had sex or nudity or hardcore violence or none of that. But there was something about that movie, she wouldn't take me to go see it. And that hurt because one of the things that my mom and I shared when I was 11 was she took me to see the Moscow Ballet perform Swan Lake.
Mm.
And ever since then, it's always been my favorite. She even bought me a music box when we were there that played the Swan Lake theme. And that was another thing that kind of stuck out to me in the film is that music box. And at one point she gets, you know, real frustrated and she knocks it off the table and it breaks the ballerina's arms and legs and head off. And so you just got a body with one leg spinning on it while the music's playing from the music box. And there's just, I think there's also a thrill, the fact that I snuck into that movie that kind of stuck with me. Mm-hmm. Is like, that was a bad moment in my life. Like, I did something really naughty. And also there was a change in my character after I saw it. I didn't feel so sweet and innocent anymore.
Because you did the forbidden behind your parents' back by going to the movie? Or was there something about the movie that...
I think there was something about the movie that triggered it.
Okay.
I mean, in the film, Nina, Natalie Portman's character, and her mom, played by Barbara Hershey, have this weird relationship with each other. She's always trying to test the boundaries. I mean, you could see she's like 20, maybe 25, 26, still living at home with her mom, and it feels like she's still a 12-year-old kid in her mom's eyes, the way that her mom treats her. And that was, I don't know, it's just something about that relationship that triggered something in me, a semblance to rebel. And I think by sneaking into that film, it was like a moment of I gave in to the darker side of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were a teenager at that time, too. And I think at roughly at that point, you're certainly becoming more emotionally complex. And you might have helped you, you know, and this is me being an armchair psychologist here. It maybe helped you kind of redefine how you looked at yourself and how you looked at your relationship with your mother. To sound all Freudian about it.
No, it's not Freudian unless there's, you know, phallic symbols
That's
involved.
True, yeah.
But I mean, maybe. I don't know. I do remember, though, that it got to the point that my nickname in our senior year yearbook is Black Swan.
Wow.
So it wasn't something that I just, it wasn't one of my phases. It's still something that's part of me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a love for Swan Lake. And I mean, I was going to go see them. The Met is performing it next week. And I was going to drive to New York to see it. And then Odessa Ballet is coming locally in January. And I'm thinking about getting tickets for that one. So it's, the duality always kind of intrigued me, that there is a good side and a bad side to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't have picked a better film to portray that in.
Okay. Yeah. And this has taken a weird left turn from what I thought we were going to be discussing, honestly. No, but, you know, thank you for kind of being open to that, though, and putting up with my question about that, too.
Of course.
This is a little bit more personal than we usually get here on the podcast. We save these personal talks for over drinks, I know.
Well, we'll go get Godfather sometime this week, I guess. I don't know.
If we must. Okay. But in the meantime, we're going to take a brief pause while we get a quick drink of water. And then we'll be back with our review of the new Jim Jarmusch film, Dead Don't Die.
Shouldn't we be telling each other that it's all going to be okay? That this will all go away like a bad dream? Ronnie?
Gee, Mindy, I'm not sure I can say that.
Cliff? Please?
It's all going to be okay, Mindy. Maybe it'll all just go away like a bad dream.
I doubt it.
All modern zombie films can be traced to George Romero's 1968 indie classic Night of the Living Dead. Produced outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania for just $114,000, the film would provide the template and the tropes for all zombie films to come, a mixture of chills and horror with an undercurrent of social commentary. Starting in 1980 with Permanent Vacation, writer-director Jim Jarmusch's films have helped set the template for the modern independent film movement. With films like Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, Night on Earth, Coffee and Cigarettes, and more, Jarmusch explored the soul and sometimes the soullessness of modern society. It seems only natural that Jarmusch would eventually try his hand at a zombie film, and that inevitability has brought us The Dead Don't Die, a zombie comedy in which a small-town sheriff played by Bill Murray and his deputies played by Chloe Sevigny and Adam Driver try to make sense of the dead coming back out of their graves. Along the way, they try to help out townsfolk like Danny Glover, Tilda Swinton, and Steve Buscemi, and passers-by like Selena Gomez. It is a night that none of them, well, at least those who survive, will ever forget. So, Natasha.
Yes.
Does Jim Jarmusch's The Dead Don't Die function as a comedy-horror hybrid? Or does it lean a little heavily on one genre rather than the other?
Comedy-horror hybrid, but it's an homage to old classic horror films.
Oh, it's a love letter to classic zombie films, going all the way back, as I said. But I think this definitely leans way harder on comedy than it does on horror. I don't think it mixes up a lot of really good thrills or scares into it at all.
I'm okay with that.
Oh, I'm fine with that too. I mean, it's a slow building of.
If it was just a horror film or a zombie film, I probably wouldn't have gone to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not true.
You know, you would have seen it because of Adam Driver, but.
Yeah. Surprised I didn't faint when I met him 2 months ago.
Okay. But let me ask you this.
Yeah.
If it had been anybody else in that role, would you still have gone if maybe there was a little bit more horror element to the film to kind of balance out where the comedy is?
Maybe. Yeah. The rest of the cast is just so phenomenal that
mm-hmm.
I probably would go to see it. I mean, come on, Bill Murray, Tilda Swinton. I worship the ground that woman walks on, and she's not on a do list. She's just, I want to meet her to say thank you for everything that you have done for film.
Mm-hmm.
Danny Glover, Caleb Landry Jones. There's just Chloe Sevigny and Steve Buscemi.
Oh yeah. Buscemi was a lot of fun in this movie, kind of playing his cranky persona in a certain spin that feels right for this time.
Yeah.
I don't want to...
Can't talk anymore about that.
It's hard to talk about comedies and horror films because so much of them both, you know, rely on surprise. And
this
so there's certain things about...
This definitely plays on some things that... I mean, you said it reminded you a little bit of Spaceballs in that way.
A little bit, in that it's playing with a lot of tropes and parodying a lot of tropes, but it's a lot more subtle. Spaceballs is very much a Borscht Belt comics version of science fiction,
mm-hmm.
because Mel Brooks, despite everything, is a Borscht Belt comedian. You know, he's got the big broad, yeah, 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 yeah. This is much more subtle. It's much more intricate. And I like that because it doesn't throw the jokes at you. It doesn't throw the humor at you. It presents it, and you kind of got to dig for some of it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. There's one that has to do with RZA.
That was great. I started laughing. You missed it, and I had to lean over and go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to go any further into that than that.
We can't. We're dancing around spoilers because the spoilers are big if we say anything.
Yeah, this is going to be a weird review for that. Especially
there's one in the third act where you leaned over and you said, "If they say this, I'm going to get up and walk out." And they said it, and all three of us went, "Oh, come on!"
Yes, that was it. I mean, honestly, the film sets up everything perfectly.
It does.
It does. It really, nothing comes as, I mean, they come as surprise, they come as funny jokes, but nothing in retrospect, you go, well, that came out of left field in terms of a lot of the humor. Now,
a lot of the plot points, however, the whole third act is a bit of a mess.
There's characters who are just... literally run out of the movie, and that's it.
Are we talking about the same character?
I'm thinking of a group of characters in particular. And another character also leaves the film, leaves the story in a way that is unusual. And I think they do a kind of subtle job of setting up, so I'm not upset about it. It's just like, well, why was this character here to begin with? There's a couple of characters that... survive you want it in a zombie movie to have a lot of characters. So you can kind of go, ooh, who's going to live? Who's going to die? It's kind of the 12 Little Indians version of storytelling, basically. You know, somebody's going to die. Some of these people are going to die. Some of these are not going to die. Some people you like are going to die. Some people you hate are going to die. And the same for the survivors. There are some characters, though, that's just, they don't even come, they're just there, I think, to be part of that number of characters for you to either root for or against them surviving the zombie apocalypse.
Almost like objective observers.
And it's kind of a little frustrating when you're realizing, like, oh, these people just came into the movie just to die, and they're not quite fleshed out.
Mm-hmm.
Again, dancing around spoilers, so this is kind of a hard one to talk about for that. But let's kind of go back. When we came out of that, what was your first impression? You said this reminded you of
Night of the Living Dead.
Yes, this is very much a...
It even looks like they filmed it in Pennsylvania.
Well, actually, they filmed up in New York.
I know they did. We stayed around just to check on that, but the way that they have it set up seems very rural Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's Centerville, quote-unquote, is very much like Monroeville, where Romero shot his early zombie films. You know, I immediately caught the Pennsylvania license plates on the cars, so that kind of tipped me that that's what he was doing here.
I love they even play with that at one point. They're like, oh, they must be from Pittsburgh. Yeah, they got that urban hipster. Oh, actually, their license plate says they're from Ohio, so I'd say Cleveland.
Yes.
Like, they actually play with that joke.
The hippest city in Ohio. So without it being like a carbon copy of the plot of Night of the Living Dead, you don't have people holed up in a house and then them interacting. You have people in the town in various locations spread out,
mm-hmm.
interacting with the zombies and with each other and trying to get from, you know, point A to point B and trying to understand what's going on. But there are other elements in Night of the Living Dead, too. You have the sporadic news reports that talk about something that might have triggered it. In this case, quote-unquote, polar fracking.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually reminded me of a 1960s British science fiction film called The Day the Earth Caught Fire. Which,
why does that sound familiar?
Maybe you've seen it, or maybe you've heard me mention it once or twice. I've seen it a couple of times. And that's a film where some experiment at the North Pole goes wrong, and it knocks the Earth's axis off of alignment, and it just gets very hot, and the planet is facing extinction because of that. There's a lot of things, like in, you know, a store, there's posters for old zombie movies, or somebody's wearing a t-shirt from Nosferatu. So Jarmusch is very much writing a love letter here.
Yeah. I mean, even the polar fracking, there was something in Night of the Living Dead that they talked about, and I'm blanking right now, and I feel like such a bad Night of the Living Dead fan. I've been in the stage show, and I can't remember what the hell it was.
Wasn't it like a satellite crashed down to Earth with radioactive material on it or something like
yeah.
that? And that's what maybe was the trigger?
I was the television reporter and the radio voice, and I don't remember what it was.
Which I think ultimately, though, means that the reason these zombies are rising up isn't important. It's just the characters and how they react to this is what's important and what the movie wants to be about. And these characters react in some funny ways.
Indeed, they do. One of the things that is constant throughout this entire thing, though, is a song.
Mm-hmm. And this is where the movie gets kind of loops in on itself, not just being self-referential to zombie movies, but being self-referential to itself. The song is The Dead Don't Die
by Sturgill Simpson.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the dead don't die any more than you or I. They're just ghosts inside dreams of a life that we don't own. They walk around.
I can't get that song out of my head. Thank you very much for playing that now.
Oh, you're welcome.
Honest to God, we saw this back to back with Shaft,
which we talked about last week on the show.
Yes. And Shaft has a recognizable theme.
A very iconic theme.
Once you get to know the iconic theme, it is very recognizable. And so that was stuck in my head. And then we went in, double feature, went back into the theater to see The Dead Don't Die. Came out, and the Shaft had completely gone away for the next hour and a half. And all I heard was that damn thing.
Mm-hmm. But it's funny how it becomes, you heard of like how a movie has a theme song, mm-hmm. but the theme song kind of became a textual theme in the movie itself. As people refer to the song, it's played on the radio. Somebody sees the CD of it and buys it at a store. It's very much a fourth wall break in a way,
mm-hmm.
without somebody actually turning to the camera and saying something. In fact, there's a few things that kind of break that fourth wall, but it's never a direct turn to the camera. And again, this is probably why I referenced, you know, why I thought of Spaceballs when we first walked out of it. There's a very specific moment towards the end of the movie that references something from Spaceballs. And they do it in a much subtler way, in a way that doesn't, you know, acknowledge the audience so much, but the characters are acknowledging that they are in a film.
Yeah.
And I think that's as close to the spoiler as I can get with, and I may have given too much away, and I hope I didn't.
I don't know. You might have.
I mean, it's always interesting. I mean, Jarmusch is known for doing... Oh, before I get there, though, one other reference. One of the tombstones from one of the first undead to rise up.
Mm-hmm.
Did you catch the name on there?
No, what was it?
Samuel Fuller.
I did see that.
The director who Jarmusch has said is a heavy influence on his own work. So that was nice. That was a nice tip of the cap to his to one of his own personal inspirations as well. But then again, this whole movie is a tip of the hat to various inspirations.
Well, can I ask a question? What the hell is Iggy Pop doing in this film? I mean, I loved it, but
I don't know. He's doing a good job. But I don't know. Maybe Iggy Pop wants to do a little bit more acting. That'd be cool. And maybe he and Jim are friends. I honestly don't know. And he just called him up, say, hey, I need a zombie. Want to hang out and, you know, on set for 2 days and be a zombie for me?
I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
And Tom Waits as Hermit Bob. That was weird. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Waits shows up in movies every now and then. Another kind of parody film Waits showed up in, Mystery Men.
I'm not familiar with Mystery Men.
Oh, okay. It came out about it was 1997, 98. And honestly, it was about 4 years too early in terms of what it was saying and parodying about superhero films. It was very much a style parody of like the Schumacher Batman films and a few other things. And I really like it. Janine Garofalo, William H. Macy is in it. Some great actors. And it just kind of bombed at the box office, but I hold a little warm spot in my heart for it. Maybe I'll loan it to you on the way out the door today.
Sounds good. There is a theme. And I know that the idea of zombies being a metaphor for consumerism has always been a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like at least one point in this film, they were not subtly doing that anymore. They were very in your face about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Particularly, there's a certain monologue. You know which one I'm talking about.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Can we call it a monologue, or is it more of a voiceover?
I think that's a quibble that I don't care to get into. Because the substance of what is said is the more important thing right now.
So my question is, why?
Why what? Why make, you know, a zombie movie then?
No, why... Oh, yeah. Why make a zombie film if you're going to take the very subtle version of what that can stand for and just push it straight into your face?
Maybe just to show people what you love about zombie movies. I don't know. Jarmusch likes to play with genre every now and then. You know, he did a vampire film a couple of years ago with Only Lovers Left Alive. But he's also kind of known for these indie dramas like Eight Men Out and...
Patterson.
Patterson.
By the way, Can we find it funny that Adam Driver's character was Peterson?
Yes.
I think that was a play on that, wasn't it?
It had to have been. There in film, there are no accidents, and that just is not an accident. So when he kind of gets to cut loose and show this other side of him, I enjoy it. And again, you know, like we were talking last week after Franco Zeffirelli died and how we, you know, kind of feel the need that we need to pick up more of his films and watch them and get familiar with them.
I definitely need to delve more into Jarmusch.
My Jarmusch knowledge is not that broad. You know, I'm kind of scattered across the decades of his output. And I, you know, I walked out of it going, I want to see more of his work. And I know it's not going to be anything like this. But if he brings that same passion to that story that he's telling in these other films that he brought to here, probably going to at least be interested, if not like it.
I might sit down and watch Only Lovers Left Alive this week because I've not seen it.
I would recommend it. It's fun. I like it. I liked it a lot.
All right, I'll put it on my list.
Okay.
But I think that just about wraps us up for this week.
Indeed. Now remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search, and hit subscribe.
And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review because that always helps us connect with new listeners. We'll be back next week with more movie talk, news analysis, and more.
And that's all here on the Big Picture Podcast. Oh, the dead don't die any more than you or I. They're just ghosts inside dreams of a life that we don't know. They walk around us all the time, never paying any mind to the silly lives we lead. For the reaping we've all sown, there's a cup of coffee waiting on every corner. Someday we're gonna wake up and find the corner's gone, but the dead'll still be walking around this whole world alone. Cause afterlife is over, the afterlife goes on.